Oh, very bad. Let's try that again. Good morning, everyone. Thank you. I'm Joan Van Diesler, the president of the Covenant of Unitarian Universalist Pagans. And on behalf of CUPS, we want to welcome you here to the first of two workshops that we're holding at this General Assembly. Our next workshop will be on Monday at 11 a.m., and it's called Humanism and Paganism, Can This Marriage Be Saved? So you might be interested in attending that discussion. Now, today's address will be taped, and copies will be available at the CUPS booth later today. Through the good effects of our volunteer, Robin Woodsong, in the back, we're able to produce these tapes almost immediately for you. Now, Tendeka is Associate Professor of Theology and Culture at Meadville Lombard Theological School. She has taught in the Philosophy Department of San Francisco State University, the Religion Department at Williams College, and has been a fellow at the Stanford Humanities Center at Stanford University and a visiting scholar at Union Theological Seminary in New York. Tendeka's new book, Learning to Be White, Money, Race, and God in America, was published by Continuum in April 1999. She's also the author of the book, Embodied Self, Friedrich Schleiermacher's Solution to Kant's Problem of the Empirical Self. Before receiving her doctorate in theology, Tendeka spent 16 years as an Emmy Award-winning television producer. A Unitarian Universalist minister and a theologian, Tendeka was given her name in 1984 by Archbishop Desmond Tutu. The name is Xhosa and means one who is loved by God. If you'll join me in please welcoming our speaker, Tendeka.
Thank you, and good morning. Is my voice projecting? Can you hear me? Hello? Is the mic, can you hear me now? Yes? Is this better? Okay. Our lips will meet. When I was a teenager, I enjoyed watching the television series Wagon Train. Each program was packed full of personal stories about settlers heading west to make a new life for themselves. The camera angles were often majestic, revealing to my eager eyes the vast length and breadth of the Great Plains. Only after I grew up and read Ralph Andrus's book, The Long Death, The Last Days of the Plain Indians, did I realize that one angle was consistently missed when filming the life of the settlers. If a camera had been placed on one of the bluffs overlooking the Great Plains of what would later be called Kansas and Nebraska and Wyoming, the television viewer would have seen an unbroken stream of garbage from one horizon to the other. Day after day, the settlers litter the trail with discarded tools, clothing, furniture, broken-down wagons, food of all kinds thrown out as equipment broke down. Baggage was discarded to compensate for the reduced pulling power of weakening animals. Animals gave out and died, and the fresh smell of green grass was blotted out by the corruption of rotting flesh. Not surprisingly, the buffalo fled, and as a result, the Pawnees, whose range was being crossed by these settlers, lost the major source of their food and began to die out without a shot being fired. The camera captured none of these scenes on film because the production team lacked three things. One, earth ethics. Two, a desire to depict the ecological disasters and loss of life that occur when Earth ethics rules for right living are ignored. And three, courage. I wish to focus our attention this afternoon on this third element, the courage required to practice Earth ethics. Let's begin with three definitions of Earth ethics. The first is by Larry Rasmussen, the Reinhold Niebuhr Professor of, there you go, thank you. The Reinhold Niebuhr Professor of Social Ethics at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. His definition of Earth ethics is found in his award-winning book, Earth Community, Earth Ethics. Earth ethics, writes Rasmussen, is fidelity to Earth. It is the awareness that the world around us is also within. We are an expression of it, and it is an expression of us. We are made of it. We eat, drink, and breathe it. And someday, when dying day comes, we will each return the favor of being to begin our role as a long, slow meal for millions of others. Rasmussen elaborates. Earth is bone of our bone and flesh of our flesh. This is not environment so much as the holy mystery of creation, made for and by all Earth's creatures together. In sum, Earth ethics is human life lived according to the awareness that all that exists coexists. Our second definition is given to us by the Zen Buddhist master Thich Nhat Hanh in his book, The Heart of Understanding. Thich Nhat Hanh calls Earth ethics interbeing and uses a sheet of paper from the book to explain what he means. And so he says, if you are a poet, you will see clearly that there is a cloud floating in the sheet of paper. Without a cloud, there will be no rain. Without rain, the trees cannot grow. And without trees, we cannot make paper. This cloud is essential for the paper to exist. If the cloud is not here, the sheet of paper cannot be here either. So we can say that the cloud and the paper inter are. You cannot point to one thing that is not here in the sheet of paper. Time, space, the earth, the rain, the minerals and the soil, the sunshine, the clouds, the river, the heat. Everything coexists with the sheet of paper. This sheet of paper is because everything else is. Thich Nhat Hanh can thus conclude that when we say something with our whole being, not just with our mouth or our intellect, we can transform the world. The third definition of Earth ethics is my own, and it emphasizes the most intimate aspect of Earth that we know, our own bodies. Earth ethics is the awareness that our bodies are astir with creation. Faith in this creation means affirmation of our bodies as the place where the touch of another becomes a sweep of feeling, a flux of sentiment, a current of ideas, the matter of engagement first felt. Each body-based feeling is a creation of the world and as such is an expression of the primal facts of human life. It is impossible to be alone because our bodies are an engagement with life. We can think of these three definitions as a call to return to early childhood in order to learn, as Larry Rasmussen says, the categories we think with when we think about things. Each definition is an invitation to go back to the time when our Unitarian, Universalist, interdependent web of life of which we are a part was Charlotte's web. and we had a talking relationship with spiders and a host of other non-human persons. In my own life, such a return would take me back to the time in which I refused to step on the cracks in the sidewalks because that's where the ant people lived. We smile easily when we recall our non-human friendships and the long childhood conversations we had with them. This was the time when we still knew that our bodies were a part of the world and as such could communicate with other bodies without having to use human words or concepts. Our world was known through the sentient language of touch, sound, and sentiment. All of us lived in this world as a child, at least for a while. But as we grew older, more and more experiences with the adult world taught us to forget this world of sentiment, mysterious delight, and joy. Fortunately, not all of us forgot the language of this world of feeling. Listen to the way in which developmental psychologist Daniel Stern, in his book, The Interpersonal World of the Child, explained how he, as an adult, remained bilingual, to use his word. When I was 7 or so, I remember watching an adult try to deal with an infant of 1 or 2 years. At that moment, it seemed to me so obvious that the infant was all about, but the adult seemed not to understand it at all. It occurred to me that I was at a pivotal age. I knew the infant's language, but also knew the adult's. I was still bilingual and wondered if that faculty had to be lost as I grew older. This early incident has a history of its own. As an infant, I spent considerable time in the hospital, and in order to know what was going on, I became a watcher, a reader of the nonverbal. I never did grow out of this. Earth ethics calls us to return to this nonverbal realm of human experience and retrieve our bilingual skills, our ability to know and affirm the world of which we are a part with our bodies as well as with our minds. But to do this takes great courage because we have to reaffirm what Stern calls our sense of a core self. According to Stern, by the age of 2 or 3 months, each of us develops a sense of ourselves as a separate physical, coherent being with our own feelings and physical history. Stern calls this sense of self our physical self and the existential bedrock of interpersonal relations. The sense of self also has been called the ecological self to emphasize its relational quality. It is this ecological self that makes us part of the natural world. Strictly speaking, we should not even call this sense of a core self an it, because the coherence of this self is a moment of relating, an act of life itself. Psychoanalytic theorist George Butterworth emphasizes this non-cognizability of this activity when noting that this ecological self, this core self, is neither a cognitive construct, nor a concept of the self, nor linguistic or even self-knowledge. It is the foundation in perception, action, and emotion for the more elaborated aspects of the self that are yet to be developed. In short, the ecological self is the bedrock of our life because it is our life as the ongoing experience of being in relationship. This is the self that knows that to be is to relate, to coexist, to interbe, to be a stir of creation. Earth ethics begins here. With the experience of being part of the world we know. As adults, we take this core activity of relating for granted. It is out of sight and out of mind. But it is more difficult to ignore this basic fact of life when we are in the presence of an infant, because we notice that if we smile, the infant smiles back. And if we respond with an even broader smile, so too will the infant. And these moments of body-based affect responses and actions will crescendo into laughter. Through numerous experiences like this, the infant learns that other core cells can regulate its own moods. But it never forgets that its experiences are its own. And so its sense of being a discrete entity does not collapse as a result of such interactions. The question is why? The basic answer is difference. The infant's core sense of self is not ruptured because of the difference between its expectation of what its caretaker will do and what the caretaker actually does. We now have to pay particular attention to this experience of difference, because it is here that we can begin to understand why it takes courage to practice earth ethics. The simplest way to understand the human experience of difference is to recall your own experience when you picked up a package that you assumed was heavier than it actually was. As you picked up the package, you were mildly startled by the difference between the actual weight and your expectation of what it would weigh. And so you made a series of muscular and mental adjustments in order to handle the actual weight. Every day, we repeatedly make such muscular and mental adjustments to engage a world that exceeds our conceptual grasp until we engage it with our senses. We then adjust our grasp symbolically and sentiently in an interplay of encounters between ourselves and the world in which we are both astirred and stir. Our grasp of the world quite literally takes place in this realm of difference between ourselves and that which is beyond our subjective experiences, thoughts, expectations, and estimations. Stern's concept of a sense of a core self highlights the difference between the infant's sense of a core self and that of its caretaker. To make this point, Stern gives us a thought experiment. Suppose, he said, that an infant experienced joyful cycles of anticipation and resolution only with its mother, and that its mother always regulated these cycles in the exact same way, which is virtually impossible. That infant would be in a tricky spot. In this particular unchanging activity, mother would be sensed as a core other because her behavior would obey most of the laws, agency, coherence, and continuity, that specify others as against selves. However, the infant could not be sure to what extent his or her feeling state was an invariant property of self or of mother's behavior, since both would invariably accompany this feeling. In this impossible situation, the mother's action would be indistinguishable from the infant's expectation. and so the infant would have no unexpected feelings that altered that alerted the infant to the presence of another person who could not be reduced to its own expectations. Stated technically, we would say that in this case, the other could not be taken into account as a thing in itself. Someone with an independent center of self-generating activity. Someone, in short, with her or his own discrete way of relating to others. Instead, the infant might feel as if it were relating only to itself. We must now imagine an opposite scenario. The adult in the world of the infant cannot make distinctions between itself and its own child's feelings. Psychoanalytic theorist Alice Miller describes this scenario in her book, Prisoners of Childhood, when noting that the child needs to be loved unconditionally. But such love is virtually impossible for a great many adults to give because they did not experience this kind of unconditional affirmation during their own childhood, and thus cannot provide such an affirmation for their own children. Instead, such parents seek an object for the gratification of their own unmet need for affirmation and turn to their own children for this affirmation. Newborn babies are ideal for fulfilling this parental need because neonates, as Miller notes, completely depend on parents. And since parental caring is essential to their existence, they will do all they can to avoid losing them. Thus, from the very first day onwards, infants will muster all of their resources to this end, like a small plant that turns toward the sun in order to survive. Adapting its needs and its sense of itself entirely to its caretakers, the child does not develop its own independent sense of a core self. Instead, the child learns to suppress its sense of feeling different and denies its own personal sense of history that does not conform to its parents' expectations, thus impairing its core ability to relate to others while keeping its own personal integrity intact. The emotions, affections, sensations, tones, moods, attitudes, and so much more that fill every moment with an irreplaceable presence called me and an unrepeatable instant called now are lost. Differences between parental expectation and the child's expressions are compromised and begin to disappear. The child thus becomes a figment of the parent's imagination, a false self. In short, it becomes the perfect child. Someone who conforms uncomplainingly to what others think is best for it. The cost of this conformity is that everything that is uniquely different about the child's sense of its own core self is threatened. To protect itself, the child thus begins to deaden, hide, deny, split off from consciousness, or in some way neglect its feelings that differ from its parents and caretakers. Otherwise, so the child has learned, it will be punished. It thus denies its own feelings in order to protect itself, and as a result, loses touch with the magic, mystery, and beauty of the world it used to know when its body was astir with creation and the child knew it. Now we can begin to understand why it takes courage to practice earth ethics. We have to retrieve our earliest feelings of delight and pleasure, in feeling the presence of others as a part of our own core sense of self. And to retrieve these feelings, we have to recall how we lost them. We lost them as our bodies were gendered, raced, and classed by our own caretakers. This is my point. In order to practice earth ethics, we need courage to free our own bodies from the cultural restrictions that forced us to flee from our own true feelings as sentient beings who are part of an interdependent web of life of the entire world. I will use a story from my new book, Learning to Be White, to demonstrate what kind of courage is needed in order to practice earth ethics. The story is about a woman whom I call Dorothy. I met Dorothy, a middle-aged European-American woman, at a dinner party in an Upper West Side Manhattan apartment. We had been introduced by our host. She was a poet, whose most recent volume of poetry was prominently displayed on the coffee table in front of the couch on which we were seated. And I was a writer working on white identity issues. After our host departed, Dorothy wanted to know what a white identity was. She didn't have one, she assured me. She was simply an American. I could help her find hers, I responded. If she wanted to know what it looked like. Her interest piqued. She accepted the offer. And so I asked her to recollect her earliest memory of knowing what it means to be white. After a little excavation, she finally found the memory. When Dorothy was 5, she and her family lived in Mexico for a year. Although her family's housekeeper brought her daughter, who was also 5, to work, Dorothy's parents forbade her to play with a little girl. Dorothy, in fact, was never allowed to play with any Mexican children, and she and her 2 brothers were forbidden to venture beyond the gates of their own backyard. Dorothy remembered her feelings of sadness and regret. The Mexican children and their parents seemed so much more at ease with themselves and each other. They seemed warm and tactile, unlike her own family, whose manners and expressions were cold and constrained. Dorothy told me she had not thought of these feelings in years. She confessed that she now recalled how often during that year she wished to be brown. I suggested that perhaps the term white might not mean anything consciously to her today, because it had too much negative meaning for her when she was 5. She agreed, and now expressed surprise that she had not written about these feelings, memories, and experiences in her work. She said much of her life had been devoted to freeing herself from the emotional strictures imposed on her by her parents. Most of her poetry was about them and the way they drained life out of her. She reiterated her astonishment that this set of memories had not surfaced in her work. As she blushed, the resurrected feelings of the child seemed to disappear. "You know," Dorothy now said pointedly, "you are the first black I've ever felt comfortable with talking about racism." I said, "Why is it so easy for you to think of me as a black, and yet until a few minutes ago, you could not make sense of thinking of yourself as a white? And further, were we really talking about racism? And if so, whose? Your parents? Yours? That of the 5-year-old girl who wanted to be brown?"
Dorothy was silent for a long moment. I now understand what I've just done, and I'm horrified, she confessed. Dorothy was horrified because she now realized that if I were a black, she too must have a race, the one that had enraged her as a child. Dorothy realized that she had indeed learned to think of others and herself in racial terms. Not surprisingly, Dorothy now confessed that she was afraid to say anything else. Not because I might condemn her, she said, but much more tellingly, because, as she put it, I might not like what I hear myself saying. Her insights had outstripped her racial vocabulary. To find the language of these insights, Dorothy would have to return to the world of her feelings she had when she was 5. Before she had conformed to her parents' wishes and become white. I do not have to tell you why such a return to this child takes courage, because each of us in this room knows what happens to bodies in this country that cannot be thought of as white. When we practice earth ethics, we have to return to our childhood experiences and remember what the race, gender, and class lessons made us forget. The marvelous way it felt to relate to differences. Differences defined us, made us individual moments of creation, unique, beautiful, whole. Most of us spend a lifetime trying to forget these feelings, lest we be punished again. This is why it takes courage to practice earth ethics. This is why it takes courage to practice the earth ethics that we preach. We have to retrieve what we lost, the feelings of kinship with the rest of the world. Only then will we discover the marvelous reality that allows us to show the world, as the Buddhist would say, the face with which we were born. Instead of littering the world and destroying all life as we deny the truth of our lives. As Unitarian Universalists, we are encouraged to practice what we preach with the seventh principle of our faith. Because this is a religious value, we are called upon to help each other live it and celebrate it, so that once again we will know with our bodies what it feels like to be a part of Charlotte's Web. Amen. Let's have a conversation. Good.
My name is Joshua. I have 4 children. My name is Robert Martin. I live in New York. And I have 4 children. And They talk about some things that in my experience kind of unveiled. And my response is something to the effect that in my experience, each child that comes with his or her own program, and if you're very lucky, you're allowed to cooperate.
A response, a I find a definition of affect useful in responding to your comments. If for a moment we can think of the way in which the mind knows as the way of ideas, the way in which the body knows is by means of affect. And affect in this way is hardwired. This is the hardwiring to which you refer. For instance, if the lining of the muscles shrink, then there is this affect which sends biochemically a signal that the organism needs to eat something. There are certain configurations such that when a neonate is born, when a newborn baby emerges, it's facial structure is such that it looks as if it feels shame, but it's not feeling shame. This is simply the biochemical hard wiring of the organism. That's a definition of affect. Emotion is different from affect in the following way. The organism senses that it is hungry, how it feels about the affect of hunger is culturally determined. So an emotion entails two aspects, affect and an idea which is socially located. How you feel about eating, what you're eating, and how much you're eating. Now with the level of affect, as the work of Daniel Stern demonstrates, there's a body way in which body knows body. When you and I talk, we will nod. There is a way in which we experience each other without having to go through cognitive aspects and variables. These body-based feelings, the tone with which you give me a cup of milk, whether you smile or not, all of these non-cognitive aspects of relating become the foundation for the symbolic language which is developed by the child. That way in which we handle relationship is determined by whether or not mom gave us milk and dad smiled. So, nature or nurture, both.
My question is about our poopers. To think that we can change our ecosystem, our environment. What is it within ourselves that allows us to live at the prayer, that allows us
since I will answer this question from the perspective of the Christian West in which we live and the culture informed by the Christian West. Hubris, pride, the sin of pride. Augustine, 4th century bishop from North Africa, gave the Catholic Church its first doctrine of human nature. And its doctrine became the basis for the Catholic teaching of the doctrine of original sin, which is taken up also by the Protestants. Augustine attempted to explain, and I'm going to get directly to your answer, so this is not going aside, it's just to give the theological context, because whether we actually believe this stuff or not,
it pervades the system, and because we relate to that which is beyond us, we pick it up. So Augustine, in order to explain how human nature was corrupted, uses the story of Adam and Eve in Genesis. And Augustine's question is this. When Adam ate the fruit, he then covered his genitals. And any of you know Augustine? This is a very important question for him. And so Augustine asked the question, why did Adam cover his genitals after he sinned? And true to form, since in Augustine's work, the punishment mirrors the sin. As Adam, the inferior to his master, rose up, against his master, and Augustine apologizes for having to be so direct. So too did Adam have an unwilled erection, and thus Adam covered his body because he felt shame. The punishment for Adam's rebellion against God was that his own body rebelled against its own master's will. Thus, shame is an indication that the individual has rebelled against God and God's appointed magistrates. What this means is that whenever anyone feels that its human nature is broken, it's that person's own fault. This kind of shame-based theology has been called a realism without a social edge. If it had had a social edge, Augustine's heaven would not have looked like the Roman Empire with its hierarchy, but rather it would have talked about what it felt to be an underling in the Roman Empire, in which crucifixion was used as an instrument of torture in which it took 7 days to die. Better to break your own child's will than have it broken by the Roman state. The sin of pride, the sin that you think that you know something that your parents don't know, that the state doesn't know. How dare you? You learn in this way to feel ashamed of the fact that your human nature was broken by those who love you the most. The analogy is this. A child is raped by its parent and then is made to feel ashamed of itself because it's not a virgin. We pick up these feelings of shame because of the unfortunate child-rearing practices of our parents and the state that extends beyond it. And we know better than to say something in protest because we will be punished again. Was this enough of a, did I get it back to your question? We do it because in this way, to go back to the site of the injury means that we will have to go back and recall all the experiences of a child that we've spent a lifetime trying to forget. The fact that mom didn't love me enough to love the child as I am. As Dorothy would say, mom wanted a white child, or mom wanted a bright child, or mom wanted this kind of a child, or dad wanted a chip off the old block. One psychoanalytic theorist has put it this way, perhaps this will help. Because we're built, we're hardwired and need relationships, otherwise we will die. And as Winnicott says, there's no such thing as a baby. You can't have a baby unless you have a community. And if the community is toxic, the baby is toxic. So the baby, in learning to deny its own feelings, splits itself from itself, which is an agony too great to recall. It thus spends its whole life trying to protect itself from being broken, and in this way protects itself from something that has already occurred. So it's obsessional. The most horrifying thing I discovered in doing this work for my book, Learning to Be White, is that I now believe I understand how Holocaust occurred. One of the protections of a broken self is rage. In this way, decent people are hacking their neighbors and friends together to apart all over the world as well as in Germany because they thought they were protecting themselves. They were protecting themselves from an injury that happened years ago in the arms of those who love them the most. But to go back and re-experience that is to recall the fact that you were broken by those who love you. To see that is to transform you. And then indeed you are at radical risk because you're out of the loop. Yes, in this way, the reason we can damage the earth is because we can't relate to ourselves. And we can't, in this way, the earth pertains in this way to feeling. I can't feel. This is something that therefore I am to use. I really am only my mind. You see, what happens when we're abused as children, and there's a wide spectrum of abuse here, we say in one way or another, out of here, I don't need the body. I'm simply a rational being. My true existence is my mind. In this way, what we think of as the radical individual is the survivor, a remnant of a war that the self lost. To feel the earth, to feel engaged, is to recognize that the body, our feelings, also have a way of telling us what is going on. And the body doesn't lie. It says, ouch. So we have to learn to numb our feelings, our bodies, and therefore the world, so we can keep the truth from ourselves, which is that we live in harrowing times.
Been placed on these students being taught to be feminine. I remember all of this. But the idea of class, I don't think they have a glimmer, right? Or it doesn't, I can't hold it, I can have a glimmer of what it's being socialized or
right. In this country, we tend, especially European Americans, to think of themselves as, or to want to think of themselves as middle class. Because one of the promises of this country is that if you're white, which again is a created identity, you'll have the American dream. Now, this is not true in this country. Most European Americans are exploited salary workers with inadequate health care, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we have to, in this way, deny, European Americans begin to have to deny the reality of their own social location, which is also at the bottom of the barrel with the rest of us. When you compare the distance between the vast majority and the tiny elite. So there's pretense that goes on. And psychologically, that's tied into the development of a racial identity. So you can feel rich,
in the laws of the 1600s, you have the right to whip someone else's slave and not to be whipped yourself while naked. Whipped, yes, but not while naked. So it's subterfuge. One other point that I didn't bring up with the earth at the question of pride, it's that what goes on is the disenchantment of the world. This is why I believe such a conversation is going on within CUPS, that this talk is being held here. The Genesis story tells us in some ways of the sacred as separated from the earth, that the earth in this way loses its sacred character. And you have in this way the divine as distinct and separate from the earth and that which has to be controlled and ruled. This is a radical departure from other ancient Near Eastern religious texts which recognize the earth as always part of the sacred, as an expression of the sacred. And the serpent in this way in the Genesis story of creation, which was an ancient symbol of the female, of matter, of life is producing from within, speaks to the woman because in other ancient Near Eastern texts, it was sacred being speaking to sacred being.
We have one more question back here, and then I see a gentleman
hitting
his hand
closer
in the far
corner. You said Thoreau, in his wall, approach, turns nature and the ultimate other into a utility to be used for his own or the person's own transcendental achievements. I thought I heard you say something similar to that. I don't think you did, but I'd like to explain that. So you said to delight and experience the other is important to our own core self. And what I guess I'm concerned about is the issue of turning the other into the utility for our own consumption or use.
Yes. I like the distinction that Martin Buber makes between relating and experiencing. Relating pertains to the way in which we actually meet and engage before we think about what's going on, the body-based feelings of encounter and how we are in this way quite literally affected. That moment before we reflect upon it and say, oh, this means this, or I'm not supposed to feel this. So the very act of relating is what I'm referring to as the core sense of self. Experience is after the fact. I've had an engagement, and now I decide how I want to think about it, the utilitarian way. Buber calls this an I-it relationship as opposed to an I-thou relationship. So Thoreau's definition pertains to it in this way. Because the vows aren't containable in this way, and all of a sudden we discover that we like persons whose ideas we despise. And that's threatening. One of the things you could do when you return home is to begin a group, say a nature walking group, which every four sessions the group would go out and look at a tree or do something or paint and something like that. The other three sessions in the month would pertain to you telling each other the stories about how you lost these feelings. And as you share the stories, quite possibly, you would discover some things that you had in common that you then might want to do social justice work around so that other children wouldn't lose this.
Thank you.
our heritage, and if we need to go back to some of the atrocities here, like slavery and genocide and memories that are given to us through our heritage, and to be able to heal that.
Right. Don't I wish that we had to go back to remember atrocities? Don't I wish? You see, one of the questions I've asked myself and that's informed my most recent work is, how is it that we live in a system of social apartheid in which we have 2 million people in prison, 80% of whom are illiterate, a number of whom are kept 23 hours a day in isolation? And if you've seen a recent edition of the Atlantic Monthly and the kind of chairs some of these people are strapped in, looks like stuff out of the Middle Ages and how they treated the insane. How is it that we can live in such a system in which there are Warsaw ghettos in our midst called the public housing projects? And know that this is not going on. And what I discovered is that this can happen, that is, good people cannot know because they first have learned how to step away from their own feelings of feeling the world as a part of themselves. The hard work is to go back and remember the way in which you were not loved by your own family. You see, I would like to ask you, sir, I would like to ask you a question. What I'm interested in is the way in which we learn to protect ourselves from knowing. What I have tried to suggest is that the protection we learn is as a child. I mean, it takes something. I mean, Robert J. Lifton wrote a book called The Nazi Doctors. He wanted to know how it was that MDs, the doctors, could go into Auschwitz and other death camps and practice their medicine there, torturing the inmates. And what he discovered is that within a week after a doctor arrived, and he interviewed the doctors who were still alive in the 70s, within a week or two after the doctors had arrived, what they saw was so horrendous that they split their feelings off from consciousness. It's this split that I have found that goes on in the very process of being taught to think of oneself as having a white identity that allows one then to be able not to read the newspaper. You see, while you're doing this, what I found is that the tone of desperation in your voice to me is an example of what I'm talking about, which is that it's so scary to go back and do the real work of how we learn to split our feelings away from our conscious life. Because I believe to the extent that we do this work, then we will be willing to suffer and die. Archbishop Tutu, who gave me my name, was once asked the question, what does it take to be a leader? He was on a panel with two other panelists who first answered the question and, not surprisingly, described themselves. And then Bishop Tutu said, I have nothing to add to this response except perhaps one thing. In order to be a leader, you have to be willing to suffer and die.
That's what I was trying to say. That I do not have the courage to die, to go to the cross,
And this is why Earth Ethics is an invitation to do the work within your own congregations with groups so that you can retrieve your feelings of being a part of the world. This is why the seventh principle of our faith, of our religious tradition, is the most radical tradition, because it's a call for you to do the work in your own congregations to retrieve your own feelings. I have discovered how Holocaust happen. They happen because we have learned to block off our own feelings. Thank you, sir. Okay.
I want to be still now. I accept you as the most honest person I have met for a long time. But to be honest, do we really want each one of us to sacrifice our life completely?
And you see, what I would ask you is, are you willing to do the small work of recalling the ways in which you learn to dismantle yourself?
Because I
want you to make your ask your question, but I want to stop for a second to reframe something that you've said, and then I would like for you to continue. I did not mean to suggest that our sense of self is lost because our mothers do not live up to our expectations. My very point was the opposite. The very point was the opposite, which is that we have expectations, and then other people act. And what there has to be is the ability to recognize the difference between the two. As an infant, whatever the caretaker is, male or female, if this difference is removed by the adult, this is an adult crime, then the child's world collapses. But it's not that we expect something from mom, but rather that mom expects something from us. The perfect child, a chip off the old block. And dad, let me stop simply using mom. Dad, whomever. Okay. So please, your question. Good. Okay. Yes, and there's also another story. If we enter into the field of the history of religions and go all the way back to Sumer, 3,000 years before the Common Era, we will find there in the history a force called Namu. Namu was the primeval waters of creation. Out of her came all the gods and the heavens and the earth and everything else. Now, I've forgotten the name of the historian of religion who traces this in the myths of Sumer. But as he traces the history of Sumer, he discovers that Namu was first demoted to a deity and then disappears. So that through the history of religions, what you will discover is that the sacred understanding of the earth and the waters as primeval and producing and female, in symbolically represented in the mind as female, subsides or is reduced, and you see in this way the rise of the male as the factor of creation. And thus what goes on with the disenchantment of the earth, the female, and the way of producing from within, from producing as one gives birth. Instead now you have a male deity that's forced, of course, to produce with its mind. So the wider context, again, for understanding the fear of earth and earth ethics is getting back in touch with the female, the way in which we know through the body, not stereotyping here, but this other way of knowing. So there's a female gender aspect here.
The entire idea with the deity was not being conscious of your own ethnicity, I think that's what I've got from it. And
Of who? Excuse me, of whom?
Of the metaphor of the baby.
Oh, yes, okay.
And not being conscious of your own ethnicity. And I'm 17 years old now. I grew up in a very diverse community and such. And I think I have a great mother and everything who taught me. Who taught me to accept all different types of people, and yet I'm walking down the street in Salt Lake City, and I see someone, and, you know, that I think looks a little, you know, sketchy, and then I'll cross the street not to walk down the street, you know, next to them. Or, you know, I mean, there's still, and my question is, what is the process by which we are made aware of our own
self-reflection, not awareness of race and ethnicity, since you aren't born with a race or an ethnicity. There's only one race, and that's the human race. And so, self-reflection. What is most radical that we do as human beings is to reflect upon the way in which we act, the way in which we know. Thus the invitation to return to our childhood, to return to the face with which we are born. In this way, to become aware of what we're doing. The question for you would be, why do I cross the street? And then to stay with the question and try to trace back the feelings, the affect story of how this happened. And then you will begin to discover things that you really have chosen to forget because they made you uncomfortable. Freire calls this a pedagogy of the oppressed. It's the raising of consciousness such that you are aware of the way in which you were formed and shaped and lost your capacity to fully resonate with the presence of others. Self-reflection, radical self-reflection tells great truths. Good. The black trench coats were self-identified as Nazis, but they were not white supremacists. They rather were trying in their own way to say that, look, I'm acceptable too.
These were kids who were radically abused, potatoes thrown in their faces, rocks thrown at them, radically abused because they were different from the jocks and the preps. And so by dressing up as they did and taking on this white aspect, they were trying to say, I'm white too, I'm white too. It seems to me that what the parents and the teachers fail to understand is that their children are in desperate straits because they live in Pleasantville. By that definition, these kids were not white. They were colored and thus had to take on the armor of white supremacy in order to try to pass.
Hi, my name is Renee Peschick from Ann Arbor, Michigan. I'm greatly touched by what you
Three ways. Recall the ways in which you began to lose this as a child. Gather together friends with children and have conversations with them about them. And as your child comes of age, make the process conscious, saying, I don't want this to happen to you. Clue me in when I tend to abridge your differences, because I don't mean to do so, but sometimes I'm afraid. This is what I would like to ask the group. I've made I've given you or attempted to give you a framework for this. I would like to know some of the things that you could immediately do when you return to your own congregations. Whether you will do them or not is not the issue, but something that's so small and handleable and containable that it's within the art of the possible. I would like for you to articulate those such that if you then do not do them, you can say, I can't even do that. And in this way, I mean, once when I had a writer's block, I said, okay, after several months of not being able to write, I said, okay, tomorrow I'm going to write one page. Came the day, I couldn't sit down, and the voice kicked in and said, you can't even write a page? And so I write a page, and that's how I broke the block, by making a commitment to do something that's very, very tiny. So now, tell us some of the kinds of very, very tiny, 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 tiny things you could do in your own home congregations to practice earth ethics. And let's just go around the room, please.
My name is Steve Landau. I'm from Oakland, California, and I'll be concerned in the way of this topic. I thought that when you spoke, even though you spoke so much about working brokenness, I kind of feel my cat, who I dearly miss, lying on my shoulder. One thing I feel that I can do is help every blessing of the animals, which I think so many people as adults connect with animals as they did with children.
I'm Amy Kelly from San Francisco. I wanted to comment that in the Vipassana Buddhist training that I've just started, we are invited to be present. And as part of that presence, we are invited to separate the sensation of hearing the feeling from the feeling. My sense is that the sensation that we are invited to feel is what you are calling heaven. Now, the tacit assumption in that is that all people have those sensations that are separable from their feelings.
Affect, hardwired.
What is not present, at least in what I've seen so far, is the fact that really the entire web has that effect.
Yes.
The sense is that if a fox falls into a log and goes to sleep, the log has a automatic response to that fox.
This is wonderful, but because we're running out of time, tell us something you're going to do. Right. So what I'm asking for are precise suggestions. Go ahead. Good. Good. More?
Beginning to understand and name those feelings that we have in ourselves. And then to begin to share. She starts to talk about that aspect. We recognize the aspect as a group and then share the
Yes, in this way you can suspend the mind story about the affect and feel the affect again, and all of a sudden you're in the midst of the world. Good. More. I love this in a number of different ways. Thank you. More, please. Let's just come on, as many as possible, please, more. Thank you. Okay.
Making sure that we do not live this only within our congregation, but in the groups that we are forming, making these groups out into the world to work in the community.
Good. Let's give ourselves 2 more minutes. Just stand up and speak and stay standing. Good. More. And speak to the group and shout. Yes. Come on, more. Yes, shout, more. I don't understand. More. Yes, look at this power, more. Yes, more. Yes, look how much we already know, more. Yes, 2 more.
I'm going to tell how big this experience has come to the GA while hearing your story about the freedom to self-thought for the first time in that dance scene. And I followed everything you said. And the reinforcement of coming to the GA just makes me feel much more confident.
Wonderful. Last one. Good. Yes, look how much we already know. Look at what we know. Let's celebrate it. Let's do it. Yes.